I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. State television in Burma is reporting that the number of cyclone deaths there has jumped from 5,000 to 43,000. The Red Cross says the toll could be as high as 128,000. But also today, the ruling military junta in Burma said it would take legal action against those caught hoarding or selling foreign aid. Well, perhaps these are some signs of recognition from the military of how terribly wrong the relief effort has gone. The UN is warning that a second wave of deaths is impending unless Burma's rulers let in much more foreign aid soon. And Burmese exiles in the region are using secret networks to try to get help to survivors. Chris Johnson has been reporting from Burma for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us now. Chris, how is the situation on the ground there?
They're in a state of national mourning. I think we need to remember that. People are very sad. They're very depressed about what's going on in their country. They're reading foreign reports as much as they can. They're trying to get on the internet, and they're hearing from friends. So they know what's going on. At the same time, it's very frustrating for them because they're not allowed to go to the devastated Delta area and help out.
What's your take on the government's statement today saying that, you know, those who hoard or pilfer or trade in relief supplies will be punished?
First of all, it indicates that the reports seem to be true, that aid supplies were commandeered and put in warehouses or siphoned off, given to friends or sold on market, rather than being delivered to the people who need it. So it indicates that those reports might be true. It also shows, perhaps, that the government is taking a little bit more seriously the pressure that foreign countries are putting on them.
We know also the Burmese government announced that it would allow a small group, 160 foreign aid workers, into the country. But, you know, there has been talk in editorials in the U.S. of a humanitarian invasion of the country. Do you think the government is reacting to that?
Well, generally speaking, they are very, very distant and aloof from the public on the ground and also from international opinion. So they may say that they're more open to aid from neighboring countries in Asia. Whether that actually opens a bigger channel for more supplies to come in from UN and other NGOs that are Western-based, I mean, we still don't know about that.
Chris, who is able to get into the devastated area?
They're not allowing reporters in. They're not even allowing in a lot of local people, local celebrities such as actors or comedians who want to go there and donate things directly to the people. They're not allowing that. And they're putting more and more restrictions on foreign aid workers.
Well, Chris, I mean, what is the sense of, you know, what happens next? The UN is warning that 1.5 million people are in desperate need of help. There could be a second wave of deaths. What's your sense?
The scale of the disaster is so huge, where you might have 2 million people who are in desperate need of food and water. And so the United Nations and other countries have been trying to finesse this with the Burmese government. But there are a lot of Burmese calling for much swifter action, even military intervention, if necessary.
You mentioned that people are calling for military intervention from outside. I mentioned it as well, that it's been called for in editorials here in the U.S. But what about a sense of an internal uprising? Or are the Burmese, you know, incapable of that because of the oppression of the government?
Right, that's a very key point. On the one hand, people are just desperate for basic food items like food and water, so it's unlikely that they would demonstrate right now. On the other hand, monks in the past have organized uprisings against the government. And a lot of the survivors are trying to take shelter in Buddhist temples where the monks are in charge. So Burmese exiles here, for example, are saying that they expect uprising for sure within the next couple of months because they haven't been able to plant their rice crop this year. And food prices are just skyrocketing in Burma. So there's all kinds of pressures going on at the same time. And you wonder at what point the local people are just going to break and say, enough is enough.
Chris Johnson of the Christian Science Monitor, who's been reporting from Burma all week. Chris, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, what's it like to watch news unfold in China if you're a Chinese visitor in the U.S. Li Zhajiang says it's difficult. We spoke with her before the massive earthquake in China, and we want to hear her thoughts about that news. But first, we want you to meet her. Li Zhajiang is the first-time author of an irreverent new memoir about life as a teenage factory worker in China just after the Cultural Revolution, a time when intellectuals were vilified and beaten. The title, Socialism is Great, is taken from a song she sang in the factories in the 80s. She launched right into it when we asked if she remembered it.
全国人民大团结，掀起了社会主义建设高潮，建设高潮。
Li Jia replaced her mother in the Liming Machinery Factory, which was run by China's Ministry of Aerospace Industry. She tolerated the indignities of daily life there, checking in with the period police, who would inspect to make sure she wasn't pregnant. Performing with the factory choir, she interpreted for us their anthem.
Socialism is great. Socialism is great. In socialist countries, the people enjoy high social standing. Counter-revolutionaries were overthrown, and the imperialists run away with their tails between their legs.
But while her mother passed her coveted toolbox to Li Jia as if it were a treasure chest, Li Jia dreamt of holding a pen, being a writer. She learned English and sang Mooney Karen Carpenter songs.
Sing, sing a song, sing along, sing a strong.
Li Jia's story is a mix of hilarity and terrible hardship.
In 1971, a group of young workers with red armbands burst into our flat and ransacked it. They took pictures from a photo album, my grandma's antique porcelain bowls, even a spoon carved with the letters USA. Harmless in normal times, these items were suspect in a nation wild with xenophobic and anti-feudal rage. Then they took my mother. We children hid behind grandma, terrified into silence, fearing the sky was going to collapse.
Li Zhajiang's mother returned from her brutal interrogation during the Cultural Revolution, but she was a ghost of her former self. Li Zha's memoir tells of straddling her mother's world and the new one she wanted to create. We began by asking, why write that story down?
Writing's always my way of making sense of my life. And also, I just felt there are so many memoirs from China flooding the market, but there are very few actually set in the 80s, yet 80s was a very, very important time. You know, the change just began.
Describe the time. Mao had died in 76?
Yes, Mao died in, and then that's marking the end of the Cultural Revolution.
But not, it didn't really end for everyone around you. Your mother was still very fearful. She wanted for her daughter more than she had, but she was afraid. You wanted to be a student. She wanted you to be a factory worker. Why?
I think of my mother being uneducated, and I don't think she ever understood the value of education. So I never doubted her good intention. I think she thought the best thing a mother could do was to secure a job and with a factory, you know, like my factory, prestigious factory. And our family was so poor, which was why my mother decided to take me out of school and put me at work.
It was an iron rice bowl job. It provided some benefits. She got some food for her family.
Yes, exactly. The state-owned enterprise provides a lot for the workers, you know, feeding us in dining halls and cleaning us in the bath houses and indoctrinating us in meeting rooms.
But one thing that becomes so clear when you're working in the factory is that because these are jobs that people have and expect to have till death, they're not doing anything. I mean, there wasn't a lot going on.
No. I'm not a rocket scientist, but I was just so numb. You know, I was not allowed to read or do anything else either.
Not a rocket scientist, maybe, but somebody with a passion for literature. You were hungry for it. Then you discovered Jane Eyre.
Jane Eyre was one of the first books in English I read. And it just struck a chord. To start with, I identified with her. because I was perceived as ugly child.
You write about how you were seen as ugly because you were browner than maybe the other
skin.
Kids. And that your hair was wavy.
I have dark skin, which is almost like a crime in many Chinese people's mind. But yeah. I just identified with Jane Eyre. You know, beneath her unremarkable appearance, she's somebody full of longing, full of spirit. Yeah. I just totally appreciate, you know, her wish to be independent and her desire to see and interact with the bigger world. And she's a rebel too.
Yeah.
So if she conformed to a Victorian convention, she would never find her happiness. So I just thought, why should I stick to my rules and regulations? There were so many we had to observe. For example, you know, red lipsticks were not allowed. High heel shoes were not allowed. And nothing was personal. And even hair, and the men's hair shouldn't be over longer than the earlobes. And I'd worked for 10 years. I never had any promotion. For one important reason, my big boss thought I curled my hair. In those days, only people with bourgeoisie outlook in life wear a perm.
Yeah, so the fact that he suspected that you had a perm meant you were doing something horribly bourgeois and
yeah.
couldn't get a promotion.
No,
even though it's
obviously
your hair.
Didn't deserve a promotion.
The descriptions you have of just this sort of lockstep nature of your life. At school, sports were limited to jogging, followed by skipping for girls, soccer for boys, or hand grenade practice for both. Throwing these you know, mock hand grenades at a piece of wood. You write, you started to wonder, is there something about the Chinese that makes us predisposed to this conformity? You start to question, is it something about us?
Yes, I just think when I started to learn English, I became quite obsessed in this language system. And some of my colleagues laughed at me, calling me a toad who dreams to eat swan's meat, meaning, you know, toad. Toad has such a degrading connotation in Chinese. It means somebody dreaming something impossible. But slowly, I just, you know, I don't care what they said. I do think Chinese have a strong tendency towards conformity.
But then around this time, you were discovering Jane Eyre, and you discovered, sure, in Victorian England, it was the same.
Yes.
Everyone was
yeah.
expected to behave just the same. You know, you mentioned people thought you were a toad having dreams of, what did you say, of a swan?
A toad who dreams to eat swan's meat.
Many of these sayings are, you know, delightful.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
many of them seem to entrap Chinese people into a way of thinking. What were some of the other sayings that your mother used or your father used or your colleagues used to sort of keep you in your place?
My sister always said, don't be different. She always tell me that a bird who flies first gets shot first.
Right.
what's the other one? Oh, yes, the wind, the tall tree catches the wind. Just don't try to be, you know, to stand out. Don't try to be different.
The tall tree catches the wind.
Yes.
And gets knocked over. So don't do that. There's also a little anecdote at the very beginning of the book about a frog in a pond who meets a turtle from the eastern sea, and the frog is so happy in this little pond until what?
Until he realized that the eastern sea is just huge. This is originally the working title of the book. It's called A Frog in a Well.
As you say at the end, upon hearing this, the frog is truly surprised and then feels disappointed and lost for a long time.
I knew there was a big, great world beyond. I just felt frustrated that I felt strongly that I was like a frog trapped in the factory, the bottom of the factory where I couldn't see the world behind. Because back then, my whole life was just trapped in that high security walls of my factory compound.
We're going to take a minute break and be back with much more here and now. We're back with more of our conversation with Li Jiazhang. She's now a journalist in China, visiting the U.S., but she's also a former factory worker. Her new book is called Socialism is Great, A Worker's Memoir of the New China. One reviewer said if David Copperfield had been a Chinese girl in the 1980s, he'd have been a character just like her. Li Jia followed her mother into a stultifying job in a munitions factory, but then began to make her own destiny. Her factory allowed her to attend TV university. She learned English, had disastrous relationships with men who treated her poorly because of her low social status, but she says she learned from them as well. She became politicized. Skipping ahead, during the Tiananmen Square events of 1989, Li Jiazhang bravely, or perhaps foolishly, organized the largest demonstration of Nanjing workers. We asked her, what did she say at that rally?
I just think we never had a say in how we are governed. Do you think this is a time we could make a difference? Shall I read the speech I gave?
Why don't you read some of it? Yeah.
Our ancestors told us that every man has a share in the responsibility for the fate of his country. Now our country is at a critical point, and we felt we just had to do something. We workers were supposedly the masters of the nation, but do we have a say in our government? Can we express our views freely? Can we vote for our leaders? The answer is no, no, and no. Even the length of our hair and the width of our trousers are subject to control. We have been locked in the shackles of dictatorship for too long.
As you say, you were interrogated after that. Would you ask the same questions now about China? Here China is coming up on the Beijing Olympic Games. People around the world protesting China's human rights abuses.
Yes.
What would you say now about the China that you asked questions of?
I would say it's a very good question, thank you. And I just think I would say that China really has come a long way. And I want Western readers to acknowledge that. And Chinese people today enjoy a much more freedom and a much higher living standard. I have no problem to criticize the government, but also I think it's wrong for the West to stand in a self-appointed high moral ground. To accuse China in this, I think the best way for me, I think best way is to and try both for both sides, try to understand each other. And I have lots of reservations about the fact China is holding Olympics. But in the end, I support it because I believe that it's best way to prove China is to engage China. And also the Olympics will provide opportunity for the people to get to know China better.
Capitalism has come to China in so many ways, and there's, you know, businesses that are running. But the state-owned factories, are they still the same? Are people just sort of slothful?
No, you know, my factory and now downsized, let off many workers.
Really?
Yes. And you have to be, you know, they have to adapt to the market economy, which is good. But also, I just think it can be quite tough, you know, for people not so capable, not well connected. Yeah.
Because they were used to the state just carrying them along, and now the state is saying, no, we have to compete.
But on that hand, there are just huge opportunities, and overall, people's lives just, you know, changed. And my sister, you know, they have 3-4 houses, and she just bought a house for her son. China's the rising power, and I think as I'm now touring around the United States, I just feel, you know, there's a growing fear about China. You know, I can understand where this fear comes from. You know, such a huge country with huge population and undemocratic. But I think some of the fear probably comes from ignorance. I think, you know, this is why I've kept saying that, you know, I hope that this is time both sides to try to understand each other better.
Mm-hmm. Your story does really illustrate how far China has come, even if, as you say, even you would criticize your government and say it has further to go. But you feel free to criticize your government openly. You write under a different name, don't you?
I used to, and mostly now I write under my own name.
Yeah. Yes. Do you feel comfortable doing that? Do you feel comfortable if this story gets back?
I'm a journalist. I believe deeply in the freedom of speech. And I think China has you know, improved so much, but, you know, there's still a cage. And often the cage has become so big, you don't feel the limit of the cage.
That's former Chinese factory worker, now journalist Li Jiazhang, in a conversation we had just before this week's earthquake. Well, yesterday we called her to ask her thoughts as she watched that disaster in China unfold on TV here.
Of course, I just feel so sad and, you know, so upset about what's happening now. But on that hand, I just feel less lucky that China has changed. You know, I don't know if you know that in 1976 there was a huge earthquake,
yes,
which killed 250,000 people, and Chinese government tried to cover it up and concealed the number of deaths. I mean, international society did find out and did offer huge generous help, and China turned it down.
China turned down the aid, yeah.
Yes, just like what the Myanmar government is doing now. It's the same. I think it's the same kind of mentality, you know, national pride, and also they somehow thought, you know, if they accepted the foreign aid, then, and you know, the people will have warm feelings, and then, you know, people will be friendly toward the West. I think the government, the communist government, just kind of feared, you know, a Chinese government at that time and the Burmese government now, just to fear the kind of engagement with the outside world.
Yeah. So Burma is now the way China was then.
Yeah. And also this government just, you know, they don't put their own people's interests first.
I know you're going back to Beijing. Mm-hmm. I'm imagining you want to be home.
I'm quite looking forward to it. I certainly want to be home, and also have been missing my children very much.
Well, Li Xiaozhang, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And when you get back to China, please convey our sympathy.
Okay.
Bye-bye. One last note about China. The government is warning that the death toll from this week's earthquake could be close to 50,000 people. 72 hours after the quake, rescue efforts seem to be focused now on searching for bodies, but there are stories of survival. State television in China showed a 22-year-old woman being pulled to safety. To her rescuers, she said, "I was confident that you were coming to rescue me. I'm alive. I'm so happy." Still to come today, we'll check in on the presidential campaign trail. That's after the news. Here and now. Barack Obama is taking issue with a comment President Bush made in his speech to Israel's parliament today. The president said those who believe in negotiating with terrorists can be compared to an American senator who would have appeased the Nazis in the run-up to World War II. He went on.
Some seem to believe that we should negotiate with the terrorists and radicals as if some ingenious argument will persuade them they have been wrong all along.
Barack Obama has said that he would meet with leaders of Iran or Syria, but today he quickly issued a statement calling Bush's comments a sad and false political attack. The White House is denying the president's statement was a slam on Obama, but CNN reports that White House aides said the remarks were aimed at Obama and others in his party. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News. He also writes The Note for the ABC News website. Rick, is there any doubt who the president was talking about? And if you have a firm opinion on that, what does it say to you?
Well, he knows he's not operating in a vacuum here. He's very aware. He's a political animal himself. He knows exactly what he's saying when he goes out and says something like this. He's said similar things in the past. This has gotten more traction, I think, because of the location. To do it in front of the Israeli parliament sends a particular message, and also the timing, because we are now very much in a mode where we're turning to the general election. We're seeing Senator Obama begin to pivot to Senator McCain. Senator McCain focused more on Senator Obama. So I think for the president to show that he intends to get involved, even in this sort of oblique way where he doesn't mention Senator Obama by name, I think is a really interesting development.
Well, can we also add that in the full statement, the president said, as Nazi tanks crossed into Poland in 1939, an American senator declared, "Lord, if only I could have talked to Hitler, all this might have been avoided." You know, throwing in the American senator, you know, might have, you know, been more than he's done in the past.
And he's never mentioned Nazis in the past, to my knowledge. Okay. So, yes, he did dial it up a little bit more. But like I said, the context is everything here. And I should say the Obama campaign is happy to engage in this argument. They almost seem happy that that this line was used, because this is something that they want to push back on. And I think it builds them up in a way to see the president take on Senator Obama, or if it's viewed that way, because right now they do want to be looking past the primary campaign and onto the general election.
Yeah. Let's talk more about what's happening within the Democratic Party, the John Edwards endorsement for Obama. You write on The Note today that Hillary Clinton just needs to move the goalposts if only Obama would stop scoring touchdowns.
Yeah, I mean, her big push now is to try to get Michigan and Florida to count. And after the big victory that she had in West Virginia, she, you know, was well on her way to at least making the argument to superdelegates after winning by 41 points. I think a lot of people were given pause by that. But then, you know, the Obama campaign pulls this out of their hat. I mean, just the timing of it was incredible. I mean, Senator Clinton was set to go on all the evening news shows last night. That was all bumped because this happened just as the evening news shows were about to go on the air. I think that was intentional, and certainly in terms of an answer to the concerns about the working class appeal of Senator Obama, there's really no more more powerful voice than Senator Edwards.
And finally, John McCain speaking in Ohio today, a speech listing his objectives for his first term, among them winning the war in Iraq by January 2013, improving health care and education, progress toward energy independence. Is this more of McCain's declaration of independence from George Bush?
Yes, and I think this was a fairly extraordinary speech. If you watch it in its entirety or listen to it, he really lays out his vision for the White House, his vision for the presidency in more explicit manner than he has before. And almost every turn, he's listing ways in which he'd be different than President Bush. This is not a laundry list of Republican ideals. This is ways that he'd be more accessible, more accountable, more in touch, better on the budget, better on the war. I mean, just every point he's seeks to go out of his way to show that or say that he'd be better than President Bush. So I thought this was a really interesting speech for him to deliver at this point in the campaign.
That's Rick Klein with our campaign catch-up. Rick, thank you. Rick is senior political reporter for ABC News. He also writes the note for the ABC website. Rick, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's get some of your thoughts in here. Bill Burtis of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, called after one of our reports on rising oil prices and the falling economy.
There's also an impact on corporations and their ability to continue to take steps that reduce their energy use. If energy efficiency steps that involve capital investment aren't being taken because there isn't the money to do them, so they're using more energy.
The bad economy is also one of the reasons there aren't as many jobs for teens this summer, as we reported. But some listeners felt we left out another reason. Kevin Erdman of Gilbert, Arizona, wrote, "I've heard economists mockingly refer to minimum wage laws as teen unemployment acts." Well, Don Boudreau of Fairfax, Virginia, is an economist. He's chair of the Department of Economics at George Mason University. He agrees. He writes, "Teenagers have few skills. It's precisely such low-skilled workers who are priced out of the job market by minimum wage legislation." Well, many of you appreciated our look back at the Democratic presidential race of 1968 when Peter, Paul, and Mary wrote this song for Eugene McCarthy.
If you love your country and the things for which it stands, vote for Gene McCarthy and bring peace to this our land.
David Gespass of Birmingham, Alabama, remembered it well. "I worked on the McCarthy campaign," he writes, "and recall that everyone hated the Peter, Paul, and Mary campaign song. Having heard it again 30 years later, I can only say it's worse than I remember it." Okay, to each his own. Well, we received a lovely thank you note this week from Michigan after our conversation with one of the authors of the new book on the history of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. The note reads, "A couple of years ago, I injured my knee, so I bought a pedometer and portable XM radio. Now, almost every lunch hour, I get away from my desk to walk and listen to Here and Now. I love it," he continues, "and your occasionally goofy style of interviewing, particularly your one-syllable off singing of Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Me some peanuts and cracker jacks. I don't care if I never get back for its root.
This note would have more punch if I were differently enabled, or if your show did something like clear cut the canopy of the secret forest of my heart. I'm not, and it didn't. I'm just a normal guy leading a normal life, which seems a little better with my lunchtime walks with Here and Now." Signed, Dan LeBlanc, wandering the streets of Michigan, listening to Here and Now. Oh, thank you, Dan. Now someone go retrieve him.
Take me out to the ball game.
Well, Marion Haupt also enjoyed the history of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. She writes, "When my father, the epitome of a diehard Phillies fan, Little League coach and umpire, died a few years ago at age 84, we knew immediately what we had to sing at his funeral. On a beautiful sunny fall day at his gravesite, we heartily sang Take Me Out to the Ball Game. I smile every time I hear it now. I like to imagine he's singing along with some baseball greats at his side." Send us your thoughts at letters@here-now.org or give us a call at 617-358-0397. Along with Dan in Michigan, you're listening to Here and Now.
It's a shame, 'cause it's 1, 2, 3 strikes you're out at the old ball game. because it's one, two, three.
Remember the controversy over the design of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington more than 20 years ago? Well, it's happening again, this time over the Martin Luther King Memorial Project. A groundbreaking ceremony was held in 2006. Construction is supposed to start this year, but questions are being raised about the centerpiece of the memorial, a huge 28-foot-tall sculpture of King. The U.S. Commission on Fine Arts, which has final say over memorials in the Capitol, says a recent model of the King statue is too confrontational and needs to be reworked. But this isn't the first criticism. Last year, there was an outcry after a Chinese sculptor was selected to create the statue of the civil rights icon. Washington Post reporter Michael Ruane joins us. First question, why was a Chinese sculptor chosen?
Well, what the people in the Memorial Foundation told me last week was that they wanted a large inspirational statue. They said that American sculptors are not that experienced in creating such statues, and they sort of went around the world to find the folks who were experienced, and that took them to China and to this sculptor, Master Li.
Li Yichen, who is known for, you know, monumental works, so those huge statues we see of, like, Mao.
Exactly.
Well, you know, we're reminded, of course, the controversy when Maya Lin, the Chinese-American, was chosen for the Vietnam Wall, in particular that, you know, that she was Asian after the Vietnam War. That really sparked controversy. But people have come to really embrace the wall. What's your sense of this statue? I'm looking at a picture. Describe it for our listeners.
The centerpiece is called the Stone of Hope, and it's a giant kind of oblong block of what's going to be granite. It's 8 or 9 feet taller than the statue of Abraham Lincoln, the Lincoln Memorial. Mm. And in the sort of face of the stone is a sort of a relief of Dr. King. The original drawings, his emergence from the stone was very subtle. But in the clay workups and models, it's much less subtle, and he is sort of stepping out of the stone in a, you know, kind of less subtle way than was originally designed.
He's got his arms crossed across his chest, wearing a suit jacket.
And the pose has put some people off, although the creators of the memorial say that it comes from a very famous picture of Dr. King kind of being very pensive and reflective, standing at his desk with his arms folded.
Yeah, and his face is, it's not a frown, it's not looking right at you, it's looking a little to the side, it's certainly not a smile.
Yeah.
How would you describe it?
It's funny, you know, I was talking last week to one of the opponents of the design, and he said the problem is that Dr. King was so many things to so many different people, and everybody envisions him in a different way.
Is this Ed Dwight of Denver?
Yeah, Ed said, you know, it's going to be hard to, you know, settle on one sort of facial expression. You know, the current model, there's a kind of furrow between his eyebrows. It's not angry, but, like, extremely pensive and thoughtful.
Well, and Ed that you spoke with is an African-American sculptor who felt an African-American artist would have been better for the subject, but as you said, is also mindful of the fact that there's just going to be many ways to represent Dr. King. When we learn that this artist, this Chinese artist, is known for these huge statues of Chinese leaders, does that affect the way you look at it, or is that just me? Because in looking at it, knowing that, suddenly Martin Luther King looks a little more like Mao.
That's been a criticism. You know, you immediately, these giant pictures of Mao or Stalin or Lenin or the North Korean leader, or even the Commission on Fine Arts mentioned these kinds of statues being torn down in countries recently. Immediately, the statue of Saddam Hussein comes to mind.
Well, and one thinks of other iconic images of Martin Luther King leaning pensively on both hands folded under his chin, more of a Lincoln-esque look. Do you think that the statue will be reworked?
That's the question of the moment. When you talk to people in the arts community, the answer is, yeah, it's got to be reworked. Although the folks in the foundation, I think, believe what we're talking about is minor adjustments. So we're going to see, you know, the Arts Commission is very powerful. You cannot go forward with a public monument without their approval.
Michael Ruane of The Washington Post. Michael, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, we're going to take a break. Be back in just 1 minute. We'll hear rock and roll with a front man with Down syndrome. Back in a minute, here and now. For most rock stars, being on stage is liberating. Pete Townsend smashed guitars. Ozzy Osbourne bit off some poor bat's head. Marilyn Manson tore up Bibles. AC/DC's Angus Young just sort of convulsed. And remember English rocker Joe Cocker? But for Bill Gage, rock and roll is especially liberating. On stage, he fits right in. He is out front with Down syndrome. Here now is Jill Ryland. How's our story about a band called Bill?
When you first hear Bill Gage sing, you probably can't make out the lyrics or decipher a chorus, or sometimes even the song's beginning or end. But that doesn't seem to matter to the people who came to see his latest show in Somerville, Massachusetts, nor does the fact that Bill has Down syndrome.
He does a really good job. Good match.
Straight up good.
He's very unique. He's very original. He does his thing. He doesn't care what anybody thinks. And he's very creative with himself.
Everyone's having a good time. Everyone's enjoying the music. And that's what matters.
On the car ride back from the concert, Bill chatted about the show with his older brother, band founder and guitarist John Gage. Their conversations can be a little one-sided. Bill can't express himself well verbally, so John ends up asking a lot of questions and translating Bill's answers.
So what did you think of the show?
I sing.
You sing, yeah.
I dance.
You dance, huh? How was it?
It's good. I like the fun.
Lots of fun?
Very fun, yeah.
Galen, for you, it was like C, C, F, G.
Bill practices in the basement of two of the band members' house. They squeeze into a tiny room with a low ceiling where they're surrounded by amplifiers and drum kits. Guitarist Eric Morin remembers a time when Bill's love of music became clear. It was back before the band was formed in the 80s when Eric and John were in a different music group.
We used to go up to New Hampshire to John's parents to do recordings, and Bill would stay with us, and he'd be up till 4 o'clock in the morning listening to music if nobody made him stop. Just sitting, listening to music, singing along until he fell asleep.
You won't hear this type of reflective story from Bill, but he does communicate what matters to him, like the records he bought the day before.
I got Queen.
Queen.
I got Pretenders.
Pretenders, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
The band's taken on various forms over the past two decades, after John first had the idea of performing with Bill at an open mic night.
Just in that one show, we really saw about almost everything about the Bill experience. You know, he was talking with the audience, he wanted to do theatrical things.
In other words, Bill started taking his clothes off. This made for a pretty awkward scene. The band wasn't even sure how to deal with their new frontman. So John suggested that Bill save his act for Vegas.
And he gets back up to the microphone. He's not happy. And he's just yelling and yelling, and he sits down on the ground, and he takes off one shoe, and he throws it away, takes off the other shoe, throws it away, pulls off his socks, throws them away, stands back up. He says, okay, this is for you.
Bill finished out the set in nothing but his pants, and the first version of the band was born. The band is called Bill because that's the only word Bill can legibly print. He can't read or write. And while it would seem to be an obstacle for composing songs, it's not. Bill comes up with his lyrics on the fly, like he did for this song. Bill sang quietly for most parts, feeling things out. Not nearly as sure of himself as usual. But by the end, the song's title, at least, was clear to him.
What are you singing there? Does it have a name?
Oh, my bones.
What is it?
Cut my bones?
Cut my bones or my bones?
My bones.
And this is how their songwriting process works. The band organizes the musical arrangements, and Bill takes care of the vocals. John says the band experiments with a variety of sounds, anything from acoustic ballads to spacey techno rock, to see what Bill likes most.
And each step of the way in this project, we've learned how to trust Bill more and how to work with him better. What he likes, what he doesn't like, what he is capable of, what he responds more to.
Through years of working with Bill, John says there's always been this accusation that the band is exploiting Bill, putting him on stage as a spectacle. John says they sometimes get hateful comments to their YouTube videos
that will say, Oh, I get it. We're supposed to sympathize with him because he's in a kind of a living hell. Like, Bill is the happiest person I've ever known. He may be limited in certain ways, but we're all limited in certain ways.
The issue of exploitation came to a head when John was filming the video for the song Bigfoot off their most recent album. In the video, you see Bill standing in a quiet residential neighborhood in front of a white house, and he's ripping through the Bigfoot lyrics. A man from the neighborhood appears and tells the band to stop. He says they're being disruptive, that it's rude to scream in front of someone else's home. He and John have an uncomfortable exchange.
Sorry we hurt your sidewalk, sir.
Well, it doesn't matter. Go find another place to do it. Do it at your house. Don't do it in front of my house.
Sorry we disturbed you.
You're embarrassing him in front of everybody.
What's so telling to me about that man's reaction is that he says, you're embarrassing him in front of everybody. And there's nobody there. Just Bill.
Galen Moore is Bill's bass player.
You know, what he's really saying is, you're embarrassing me. I don't know how to react to this. I'm uncomfortable with this.
And it's the expectations of strangers that because of Bill's Down syndrome, or DS, he shouldn't be singing on the street or in a band that bothered John the most.
The idea that you can judge what's going on inside a person, whether they've got DS or not, is outrageous.
You're my...
And in the same way that John doesn't like when outsiders judge Bill, Eric Morin doesn't want the band to be pigeonholed either.
We're not a band with a Down syndrome singer. We're a band. And if you like us, great. If you don't like us, that's fine too. I would hope someday that people could just say, oh, that band Bill, they're great. That's it.
Until that day, the band is ramping up their concert schedule. Their MySpace fan numbers are into the thousands, and they're working on a third album. And John says all Bill wants to do is just keep going with it all.
He's always saying, I am ready. I am ready. He's waiting for everybody else to get their act together so that he can do what he wants to do.
Like dance on stage with his best friends, or sing for adoring fans while his band plays behind him. But not just any kind of music.
I like to play loud.
Do you like playing soft, too?
Yeah, I like loud. Loud.
All things to things. I want that down. I want that down.